Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, December 19, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on American Retreat, the New Isolationism, and the Coming Global Disorder. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome the author of the new book, America in Retreat, The New Isolationism and the Coming Global Disorder, Brett Stevens, who is the Deputy Editorial Page Editor and Foreign Affairs Columnist at The Wall Street Journal. A more complete bio of Mr. Stevens was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and talk a little bit more about how today's call is going to go. I think Brett is going to start off telling us a little bit about his book, and then we're going to have a conversation covering the book. And then for those of you who are regular listeners, I think we're going to open it up to questions just a little bit earlier than we normally do. So for those of you on the line, as we start discussing his book, think of questions, and then we will probably open the lines up a little bit earlier and allow you to engage in the conversation as well. So without anything else, Brett Stevens, go ahead and tell us briefly a little bit about the book, and we'll go from there.
Well, thanks very much for hosting this call. I know the listeners were glued to President Obama's press conference, and I'm grateful that they managed to carry themselves away to listen to me. Look, when I started writing this book, I signed the contract for it around the time Hurricane Sandy was hitting New York City. The idea of a coming global disorder seemed probably far-fetched to most people. There was a general sense that the world was a generally benign place. We had reset relations with Russia. We were still thinking that the Arab Spring might turn out well. There was a feeling that, as the president put it, core al-Qaeda was on a path to defeat, and that the United States could take a breather from its involvement in global affairs to focus on what President Obama frequently called the task of nation building at home. And that view was not simply a view on the progressive left. It was also a view widely shared in many corners of the right. Republicans who felt that an interventionist, an active foreign policy under the second Bush administration, George W. Bush, had led us into two deeply disappointing wars, if not, in fact, failed wars, that it had cost us a great deal of capital for very little gain, and that the law of unintended consequences was as robust when it came to foreign policy as it did when it came to social policy or domestic policy. So as I was writing this book, as I was beginning to write this book, I think it was probably a deeply unpopular view. But even then, back in 2012, it seemed to me that there was a considerable amount of evidence that we were entering into a period of what I called the coming global disorder. I wrote an article in Commentary magazine to that effect in September or October of 2012, and furthermore, that there was a connection between the foreign policy on which the president had embarked and this new kind of disorder, which I was forecasting. And to establish it in the simplest terms, it was this: the world had lived under what is sometimes called Pax Americana since the end of the Second World War. We were entering into an era of post-Pax Americana, not the post-American period, as Fareed Zakaria has put it, but the post-Pax Americana period, and that was going to create power vacuums that would inevitably be filled, and often filled not by benign, responsible powers, but by ambitious revisionist dictatorships or movements. So this was what prompted the writing of the book. The second thing that prompted the writing of the book was I've written this really with a view toward influencing the 10 or 12 people who are going to join those early GOP debates. It seems to me that the Republican Party is a party in search of a foreign policy. It's easy today to criticize Obama, and there is much to criticize, and there's if you want to read a critique of his presidency, you can turn to this book. But the Republican Party also is, a little bit tongue-tied and intellectually stunted when it comes to spelling out a foreign policy that succeeds in or that does not respond to Obama by falling into the trap of promising overcommitment abroad. How do you find a Goldilocks foreign policy that is the middle course between the kind of the policy of deliberate inaction that has frequently characterized Obama's view, and the overcommitments of the Bush administration? And so what this book attempts to do is to spell out that middle road, a conservative foreign policy which is serious, sober, but more evolutionary than it is revolutionary, more interested in maintaining order, or certain kind of order, certain kinds of norms and expectations around the world, rather than an attempt to win hearts and minds. And so that is my core audience, if you will, those candidates and the people who may staff the next GOP administration, to give them what I hope is a guide to a foreign policy that that is good for the world, good for the United States, and also can be sold politically to the American people. So that's the essence of the book. I'll make one final point that I think is important. I called the book America in Retreat, but I did not call it America in Decline. And an entire chapter in the book is dedicated to explaining why I think the kind of declinist view is simply wrong. And that's a view that is also shared on the right as well as the left. In fact, people who think that we're in decline will often say, well, since we're a country in decline, we need a strategic retreat because we can no longer afford the kind of commitments that we had throughout much of the Cold War and the post-Cold War period. So decline becomes a prescription for retreat. But I think decline is the wrong prescription. I think decline fundamentally misunderstands or underestimates the extraordinary strengths of the United States and the comparative strengths of the United States. It's not decline isn't simply, you know, what is happening relative to our expectations for ourselves. Decline is also what is happening relative to where our competitors are. And if you measure our position in the world compared to the Japanese, to the Europeans, to the Russians, and yes, also to the Chinese, I think we're in a very, very strong position to be the world's leading power, certainly throughout my lifetime, and I would wager right through to the end of the century. So this is not a case for decline. It's a case against retreat. Retreat is a policy choice. Decline is something that happens beyond the power of any single political leader to reverse. I should make one final point, having promised you that was the final point. This book spells out in a scenario that takes place in the year 2019 the kind of things that we might expect to happen in the world if we proceed on current course. I think it's a fairly realistic scenario, but it also offers a chapter on how we can move ahead and what it means for the United States to play the part of the world's policeman. So that's the book. I've already taken too much time to explain it, and now I'll turn it over to questions.
Fantastic. Well, one of the things I noticed is that the book has been praised for its grasp of history and sort of the big foreign policy ideas, that may come from everything from history books to your standard, intro to international relations course, but really relates those well to the issues that we're facing today. I wanted to ask you, could you talk a little bit about the history of sort of what you talk about with neo-isolationism, going back to the beginning or the mid 20th century, and maybe give some examples of where of times when America's retreated that, you know, show as examples of what happens when America isn't involved.
Well, thanks. So the new isolationism is part of the subtitle of the book. I treat isolationism as a very serious and respectable foreign policy tendency. For isolationism isn't really an ism, it's not an ideology. It's a tendency that has been present really from the beginning of the Republic, if not all the way back to the first Massachusetts Bay settlements. You know, peace, commerce, and friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none, that's taken straight from Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address. We had the term isolationism emerges from the British concept of splendid isolation. So it was a term that attempted to see America as a nation apart, an exceptional nation, a nation that had the luxury not to have to muddy its hands in the power politics of the rest of the world, a nation that could cultivate not only its own resources, its own backyard, but also cultivate a sense of distinctness, a sense of democratic virtue, a sense of republican independence that countries like France or Prussia or whatever, Austria-Hungary didn't have at the time. And so isolationism, at least from an intellectual point of view, it wasn't always honored in practice, but certainly in principle, was the default foreign policy of the United States all the way up until the First World War, where we had a president, much like George W. Bush, who in a crusading spirit took America to war for the sake of making the world safe for democracy. It was the first example of the freedom agenda, as George W. Bush would later put it, in foreign policy action. And for a variety of reasons, disillusionment with the war, disillusionment with the peace, Americans elected a president from the opposite party, opting for a very different kind of foreign policy, opting for what Warren Harding called normalcy. Isolationism does not mean not having a foreign policy. Isolationism is simply an instinctive sense, a tendency to believe that an America that involves itself too deeply in the rest of the world's problems is not going to help itself, and frankly, it's probably not going to help others. And that was the guiding view of American foreign policy statesmen in the 1920s and 1930s, not just the three Republican presidents of the 20s, but also the first few years of the Franklin Roosevelt administration. But what we learned is that when the liberal democratic countries are not willing to police the global order that they have announced, the dictatorships will very quickly sense that fact, and they'll take advantage of it. And so we had in the 1930s the infamous case of Japan signing the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which outlawed war as an instrument of national power, signing it in 1930, and then promptly within the space of a year invading Manchuria. And after that, Italy also sensing that it was open season for their colonialist designs, promptly invaded Abyssinia, using chemical weapons in warfare, by the way. And then after that, we had Germany invading the Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia. So the 1930s was a period when, because for a variety of reasons, France, Britain, and the U.S. had abdicated their responsibilities as the victors and guarantors of the post-World War I era, you had a period where where ambitious dictatorships rose, sometimes in alliance, sometimes contending with another, to fill the breach. And people know what the result of that was. Franklin Roosevelt had to spend 3 years educating the American public in his famous quarantine speeches before America came around to a sense of the danger it faced. Now, after the Second World War, it was not a given that the United States wouldn't simply repeat the pattern that it had gone through after the First World War. I mean, what was it that kept America after the victory in Tokyo Bay from not simply just once again retreating behind its oceans? And it really took a very conscious decision by the Truman administration to begin to exercise the function as the world's policeman, first for the sake of Greece and Turkey. That was the origin of the Truman Doctrine, then extended with the Marshall Plan, the action in Korea, and so on. And so that was the birth of Pax Americana. And it's worth remembering, I mean, one of the things I do in this book is I examine what one very famous left-wing Democrat, Henry Wallace, who nearly succeeded Roosevelt as president, and one very famous right-wing Republican, Robert Taft, who also had presidential ambitions, their critique of the Truman Doctrine, their critique of America becoming the world's policeman. And they sound pretty much exactly, you know, mutatis mutandis, as they say, pretty much exactly the way Barack Obama and Rand Paul do today. So what one of the things that this book tries to do is rehabilitate that centrist tradition of Harry Truman and Arthur Vandenberg, Dean Acheson and Dwight Eisenhower, who understood that America would never be prosperous and secure unless we became, in some sense, a meaningful guarantor of global order.
Excellent. Well, you mentioned that, you know, this book is supposed to be, you know, a blueprint or a guide for the Republicans running for the presidency next time. And I'm intrigued because you make the case that that military intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan were the right courses of action, just foolishly executed. And, you know, how would the next president make the case, go about making the case, particularly in areas like the Middle East where national security is so important with this ongoing war on terror, you know, should there be a need for another type of military intervention, you know, after over a decade of war, you know, how does a candidate make the case, you know, going forward, you know, that we need to contribute, you know, significant resources, whether financial or military resources to that region, particularly after the experiences we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I would say that the next, you know, let's imagine you are a Republican candidate X, and you're in your debate and someone says, well, what about the Iraq war? What do you think of that? Say you're Jeb Bush, right, to make this a more concrete situation and perhaps a more plausible one. What would I say in Jeb's shoes? Well, obviously there's a family difficulty, but I would say, look, the reason we should have gone into Iraq, which was right to do, was to make an example of Saddam Hussein, who had been a 25-year-long security crisis for the world. Among the mistakes in Iraq, but the biggest mistake in Iraq was that we went from trying to make an example of Saddam Hussein, who was himself a weapon of mass destruction, to trying to turn Iraq into an exemplary state. It wouldn't just be a country that wouldn't threaten us or its neighbors again. It would become a model Arab democracy. It would have women well represented in parliament. It would have oil distribution schemes that were fair to all sides, one thing after another. It would be de-bathified. The military would be reformed from the ground up. I remember listening to Paul Bremer in one of his first public appearances for the World Economic Forum after he had arrived in Iraq, and he was sort of describing this kind of Reagan-esque vision of deregulating the Iraqi state and improving the bidding process for Iraqi government projects. And you were kind of listening to this guy and saying, "Oh dear." So that's the first point. The second point is, the business of foreign policy is primarily about being a good friend. Are we being today a good friend to the Israelis? Are we being a meaningful friend to our allies in the Arab world, allies like Egypt? Do we really have their back? Do we think that the Japanese, the Taiwanese, the South Koreans are really feeling reassured about the quality of the pivot that they've seen so far, which has yielded very little in terms of actual military power to Asia? Do our friends in Poland feel that if Russia should make an aggressive move, that we're going to be there for them. What about our friends in Estonia and so on? So this is point one. The business of being a superpower isn't, or of being a responsible global power starts with being able to provide meaningful security guarantees where they are needed most, on the far frontiers of the free world. The second point is, we don't want to pursue a policy of occupations. We should not be in the business of healing crippled societies or trying to heal crippled societies. But we should be in the business of trying to keep our nightmares at bay. And a smart foreign policy begins not by saying, well, what are the wonderful things we would like to happen in the world? You know, peace between Israel and the Palestinians, for example, or an Arab democracy in Iraq, or things of that kind. And let's ask ourselves instead a negative question. What are the nightmares we must keep at bay? What are the things we must not allow to happen? Let's come up with a list of, say, our five nightmares at bay, and then ask ourselves, what do we have to do to make sure it doesn't happen? I would say Iran with nuclear weapons is one nightmare. An accidental war beginning between China and one of its neighbors, say the Japanese or the Taiwanese, that would end up involving us. A third would be Russian invasion of a NATO member state. So then you start to construct a practical foreign policy, because you can say, okay, we can't allow that to happen. Now what have I got to do to make sure it doesn't happen, and how can I start working on it now, rather than taking the Obama prescription of waiting on events and then reacting often too late?
Fantastic. Well, you mentioned Russia. Let's pivot there. A couple of years ago in the presidential debates, Mitt Romney was mocked for saying that Russia was our biggest geopolitical foe going forward, and the events of the last couple of years have seemed to coincide with Governor Romney's statement there, and the rise of Russia seems to cast some doubt on whether hitting the reset button has actually worked. So, talk about going forward. You know, obviously, a lot of our interest and a lot of these issues are linked across the world, from the Middle East to Russia. Talk a little bit going forward about how the United States can sort of counter this rise of Russia through strength and through sort of how you're plotting or your course of action, and how also again a Republican candidate can frame this without going back to sort of a Cold War mentality and coming up with a 21st century version of American foreign policy.
Well, right. Let me just take a step back from that question. I think there is a connection between Russia's seizure of Crimea and then its invasion of eastern Ukraine in the spring and of 2014, and the breaking of the red line commitments in Syria in 2013. And the connection isn't exactly causal, but it is environmental. Putin understood, after Obama walked away from his red line in Syria, that it was open season, that this was a president whose threats, whose red lines, whose warnings were effectively hollow. They were meaningless. And so what we ended up entering into is a kind of broken windows world where pretty much anything goes, where the signal is sent that, one window is broken and left unrepaired, and the next thing you know, other windows get broken. And not surprisingly, the thesis of my book is that in a broken windows world, what you really need is something very much akin to broken windows policing, which is a theory I'm sure most people on this call are familiar with. Now, so Putin has invaded Ukraine, and there are a couple of points that are worth making in that connection. Number one, our failure, I think, to extract a very high price on Putin following his seizure in Crimea was the inducement that he was looking for to then follow through in eastern Ukraine. And I think that's going to continue, may even accelerate now that he's under a great deal of economic pressure. Our failure to send a meaningful signal that the seizure of Crimea was an intolerable act that would meet with real penalties was a great mistake. Just imagine if we had imposed punishing sanctions back in March of 2013 that could have put him under the kind of economic stress he finds himself in now, rather than wait on events and wait for the next stage in that drama. Maybe there wouldn't be 300 dead passengers in a field in eastern Ukraine. Obviously, I'm speculating, but that's one thought to put out there. The second thought is we had provided Ukraine with a promise in the form of the 1994 Budapest Memorandum that we would guarantee, along with Russia and Britain, would guarantee Ukraine's territorial integrity in exchange for them relinquishing their nuclear arsenal, which at the time was the third largest in the world. Leaving aside the kind of the dishonor of failing to at least do anything to meaningfully honor the Budapest Memorandum, what kind of signal does that send the next time we try to get some country to do our bidding by making a promise, a presidential promise of that kind? I think it's a dreadful signal. And the third point is that irrespective of your view or one's view of Ukraine itself, the fact that Russia has done what it has raises profound questions about American security guarantees elsewhere in Russia's neighborhood. And unless we move very quickly to reassure certainly our treaty allies, but other countries in the neighborhood, that this time we'll respond differently. This time we'll respond more in a more muscular way. This time we're not going to wait and cross our fingers and hope for Vladimir to do the right thing. Then in that case, we're going to be entering into a world of trouble. I think Putin right now, precisely because he is under so much economic pressure, is going to be more aggressive, not less. I mean, a confident tiger, which is Russia with oil at $115 a barrel, is dangerous. But a wounded tiger, Russia with oil at $60 a barrel, is even more dangerous. And I think we're actually entering into a period of a very significant geopolitical danger with the Russians.
Well, why don't we, we've got a number of callers on the line. Why don't we go ahead and see if our callers have any questions based off what they've heard already. So we'll open it up. Now, if you'd like to get on the line to ask a question, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. All right, we'll go to our first caller now.
Yes, just my name is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society. A country that you didn't mention, a country that is at least used to be very much a stalwart and important American ally, is Turkey. Mm-hmm. You didn't have anything to say about Turkey. And Turkey, despite its NATO commitments and despite years of alliance with the United States, Turks fought in Korea, among other places, I guess. We can't seem to get them to let us fly airplanes out of their air bases located on their soil, and they seem to have adopted a very sort of alienated position from the professed American interest in Syria, which borders Turkey, Iraq, which borders Turkey, and not a great deal of interest in the Caucasus, Georgia, where the United States is arguably overextended in the face of real Soviet pressure, Russian pressure. I'm giving away my age. There's not much we could do about Georgia. So what do you think about Turkey?
Well, Turkey is no longer an ally of the United States. That's what I think about Turkey. It is, Erdogan is and always has been a committed Islamist. He has been a clever Islamist in that he understood that the way to seize power in the way he has in Turkey was not through a revolutionary process, but by a series of incremental steps, but he is well on the way to fundamentally transforming the nature of the Turkish regime itself. First of all, it's as we've now seen, it's become a presidential system, not a parliamentarian system, with his ascension to the presidency. It shares some important aspects with Putin. I think he sees Putin as a role model, and you probably read the news of the arrest of 27 Turkish journalists in the last week or so. Turkey incarcerates more journalists than, I believe, any other country in the world. People are familiar with the fact that that Turkey has been funneling arms and allowing the transit of men to join groups like Jabhat al-Nusra, which is basically al-Qaeda, if not to ISIS itself. And there's also the state of Turkish relations with Israel, which was once a close ally of Ankara. So what we have now is a bit of a difficult problem, because Turkey remains inside the belly of NATO, but as a no longer as an allied state, and that at some point that is probably going to have to change. Either Turkey is going to change back to what it was, or the West is going to come to accept that Turkey is no longer an aspiring member of the West, but has other ideological and theological commitments. So this is the question for American foreign policy. One thing that I find striking is that Obama went out of his way to describe Erdogan as one of his five best friends in the world, along with David Cameron and a few other people. And so it's an indication of the quality of Obama's personal diplomacy that this guy, with whom he supposedly has such terrific influence, has conducted the kind of foreign policy that he has. The failure of the Turks, or the refusal of the Turks to allow the U.S. to act against ISIS from the Incirlik air base, is just the latest slap in the face at the Obama administration, and it says something about a policy, about the results of a policy of feckless ingratiation, which I think has been part of the problem, not the whole problem, but part of the problem with this president's approach to foreign policy.
Do you see any future then for the United States in terms of its diplomacy or other strategic relations with Turkey?
Well, look, I mean, I love the Turks. I wrote my master's thesis on Turkey. It's a wonderful country, and you go to a place like Istanbul and you find a very large number of people who are secular-minded, Western-oriented, thoughtful 21st century people. But you know what? During the last parliamentary or municipal elections, I should say, they got trounced, despite the protests in Gezi Park or near Taksim Square in Istanbul. They got beaten. Erdogan is not simply, I mean, Erdogan is a good, like Putin to some extent. It's wrong to describe Erdogan exactly as a dictator or a tyrant. He's an illiberal Democrat. He is there by popular consent, but governs through by illiberal means. And until the Turks decide that they no longer want to live under that kind of dispensation, our problems with the Turks are going to worsen. I once did an interview with Bernard Lewis, the great historian. And I asked him about Turkey, and he said, you know, my prediction is that in 10 years, Turkey and Iran will switch places, that the Turks are moving not just as a government, but as a people in the direction of Islamism, and Iran, or the Iranian people at least, having been so thoroughly disenchanted with their Islamist government, may in time return to what they had been in the days of the Shah, a secular Western-leaning country. And that's I think that's not a bad prediction.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon, Mr. Stevens, Glenn Taubman. I love your columns. Thank you so much for putting it out there for all of us every Tuesday.
Thank you.
So I guess as I read day after day, I look at the world and I just see what I call amoralism, like nothing is moral, especially among like Western Europe. It seems like they're just totally lost with, you know, this Hamas is okay, Israel is bad. Boko Haram and Taliban kill day after day, and, you know, they blink and do nothing. And, you know, Cuba and North Korea enslave their people and Americans and others. And, you know, everyone sort of shrugs. It's like there's nothing moral in the way the people who run foreign policy look at the world. And I guess I'm asking you if you have any thoughts about that, about where's the morality, if there is any, and why is there no morality in the way they look at the world and can actually distinguish between good and bad, evil and good? You know, it just seems like there's no distinction anymore for most of these policymakers in Europe, and unfortunately in the White House and the State Department too.
Well, I guess what I would say is it's not that there isn't any morality, it's just that it's a very selective morality. So fulminations on the subject of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, but silence on the subject of Turkish settlements in Turkish-occupied Cyprus. And you know, you go down the list. Look, it's very important for any serious foreign policy to contain an ethical dimension without being overwhelmed by the ethical dimension. And how you go about doing that, of course, is a matter of, you know, prudence and judgment. I mean, if you conduct a foreign policy that's simply an extension of ethics, you're not going to last very long as a great power, because great powers have to do all kinds of things that cannot easily be judged in a purely ethical light, whether it's enhanced interrogations or drone strikes and, you know, death penalty from 30,000 feet on whoever happens to be below. This is the nature of international politics. But what worries me is that we have an administration which seems to be very good at scolding its friends and coddling its enemies. I'm not quite sure what the ethical approach is there, but we do need a foreign policy that understands the values of friendship, of loyalty, and is able to say, well, some countries are more like us than others, and we should be more sympathetic to those who are closer to us than those that are farther away. I mean, how is it possible that Obama, I'm reprising something I said to the last question, how Obama can have such a terrific relationship with Erdogan and such a lousy relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu? There's something kind of perverse about that. Last I checked, Netanyahu was not imprisoning journalists and was not harassing American ambassadors and so on. So I guess what I would say is, what we want is a foreign policy that adheres to Machiavelli's great maxim that when it comes to an approach toward other nations, it is very good to have a reputation as a firm friend and a thorough foe, and that's, I guess, what I would want first and foremost, that the United States once again reacquire its reputation as a firm friend and thorough foe. I mean, the mantra of the U.S. Marines is no better friend, no worse enemy, and it's a terrific mantra. It ought to be the touchstone of American foreign policy.
All right. Well, we've had three questions jump on the line, so we'll go right to those.
Hi, this is Lenore Ostrowski. I'm a member of the Federal Society. I know this is hard to do, but can you put yourself in the shoes of the people advising the president, or even the president himself, and describe what they think they're doing? I mean, you know, people on this line are probably opposed to what he's doing, but he thinks he's doing something in particular. And I haven't heard a very cogent explanation of what really he thinks he's doing without casting aspersions on it, which one would want to do if one were opposed to what he was doing.
Yeah, I devote an entire chapter of this in my book. And, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do in my book is treat the people who disagree with me with some intellectual respect. So this is what I would say Obama is doing, as he or his advisors are doing. They would say the following. They would say, when we came to office in 2008, 2009, there was a desperate need for the United States to retrench. We were trapped in two fundamentally unwinnable wars, and we had to extricate ourselves from those wars responsibly but resolutely. We did that. Secondly, we had to appreciate that there are limits to American power. There are limits to what we can do, especially in an era where there's so many other claims on our attention and on our resources. And so therefore, we decided that because we simply couldn't cover every corner of the world, we were going to focus on the corner that mattered most, and that was Asia, hence the pivot to Asia. In order to do that, we also needed better relations with some other countries, hence the reset with Russia. Importantly, too, for us to continue to conduct a credible foreign policy, we had to restore America's good name in the world. And just the mere fact that Barack Obama is not George W. Bush went far towards accomplishing that, but also speeches like the Cairo speech in 2009, or even the speech in Berlin when he was a candidate in 2008, closing the Guantanamo Bay facilities, outlawing the use of enhanced interrogation techniques, all of this was important because if we are going to exercise power, we need moral legitimacy, and we had lost much of that moral legitimacy in the Bush years. Another thing they would say is, look, what we've learned is that often what you need in this world is light footprint. And especially in an era of strained circumstances, you need it not only because it's the right thing to do, but frankly, because it's probably all you can afford to do. So why occupy other countries when we can train their police forces, when we can partner with them in various kinds of ways to allow them to do what they need to do for themselves? But above all, they would say that ultimately the United States has to choose between having the kind of domestic agenda that will fulfill the president's vision for a socially just society, on the one hand, and on the other hand, America as the world's policeman. And there, Obama kept saying, I want nation building at home. That's my choice. Yes, we are still a major power. Yes, we still have global responsibilities. But at the end of the day, my vision for a better America is not about what we do abroad. It's what we do here at home to give every American the health care that he or she needs, and so on, the litany of entitlements. So that's the argument that I would, you know, that I would make if I were in their shoes. And in 2008, 2009, that was enough of an argument to persuade a majority of Americans that this guy should be president, right? And even in 2012, Obama's foreign policy ratings, I think, were broadly favorable. Mitt Romney was seen as a guy who, you know, what was the line? You know, the 1980s called, and they want their foreign policy back, a throwback. All of a sudden in 2014, we are learning that, in fact, we can't just choose between domestic policy and foreign policy. It's true that to be strong abroad, you need to be strong at home, but it also turns out that to be strong at home, you also need to be strong abroad, that allowing crises to fester far away in northern Iraq or other places ultimately is going to cost us both in terms of lives and in terms of money. What we learned is that we have one world economy. We can't just simply imagine that the troubles of the rest of the world are no business of our own. And what we learned finally is that there is no substitute to American power. You know, in Britain, when Britain basically conceded the role of world's policeman in 1946, 1947, they could look west to the United States, which was a country that was also a democracy, also an English-speaking country, a responsible country, and they could say, okay, we can hand the baton off to the Americans to the Yanks because the Yanks are on our side and they're good guys. But to whom do we hand off the baton? To the UN? To the Chinese? To Vladimir Putin? To Brussels? There is no alternative to American power. And I think Americans are beginning to understand this, have come around to or have been reminded of this fact this year.
All right. Well, we have four questions pending, so we'll get to as many of those as we can with about a little less than 15 minutes left. We'll go right to our next question.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Stevens. This is Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. Regarding the president's intention to normalize relations with Cuba, whatever that might be, whatever forms that might take, there seem to be two schools of thought, at least two. One is that this will benefit the impoverished Cuban people, will provide them with new economic opportunities, and it will trickle down, and perhaps even one day we'll look back and see this as the spark that led to freedom for the Cuban people. Another school says that this will simply embolden and strengthen the Castro brothers and provide them with additional resources to stay in power. And them and whoever succeeds them will be in power indefinitely. Where do you come down on that? What do you think the effect of whatever we're going to do with Cuba will be?
Well, look, I am not unalterably opposed to a new policy, a new look policy at Cuba. And I'm not unalterably opposed to lifting the embargo, but I fear that what we've done is we've given up a great deal of leverage from the beginning for the sake of a kind of a photo op moment that won't be properly reciprocated as this moves along. I mean, this is a president who loves announcing resets of relations with other countries. And the resets have a way of failing. So Cuba is another one in this list. You know, are we sure that we are going to have a step-by-step process where every concession made by the United States is going to be met by equal and irrevocable concessions by the Cuban government? I don't think that process is in place yet. I don't even think the administration has thought it through. They seem to imagine that when the Castro brothers die, a new day is going to dawn in Cuba. But the truth is that that's an entrenched military dictatorship that profits or that has found ways to profit from its commercial ties with the outside world, with the Europeans, with the Latin Americans, and now perhaps with us. So we need to be careful that we are not making a deal with the Cuban government at the expense of the Cuban people. I mean, what we should have is a policy that helps the Cuban people at the expense of the regime. And you know, my basic objection to this agreement, well, I have a number of objections, one of which it was sprung on the American people. There was no consultation with Congress. There was no attempt to, you know, have a conversation about a new policy towards Cuba before this was announced. But my bigger problem is that I just, having looked at the 6-year record of the Obama administration, I don't trust them to execute this in a tough-minded way. You know, there's a reason why negotiations with Iran aren't going anywhere, because we're lousy negotiators, because we make all the concessions up front, and then we're left wondering why we're left with no leverage. So I just have a bad feeling that we're going to reprise exactly that scenario with Cuba.
All right. Well, we've still got three questions pending, and we'll go to those as quickly as possible.
Karen Lugo, also Federalist Society. A broken windows policy takes an acuity or an ability to make judgments as to what are early threats to the order. And when you look at what has recently played out in the United States on the part of private entities in response to the threat from North Korea and the retraction of showings of movies. What does this say to you as far as America's ability on a private level to stop retreating?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the problem with every great theory of international relations is that, you know, the theory that a Henry Kissinger, that a Hans Morgenthau constructs and that a Henry Kissinger attempts to implement is very different when John Kerry is attempting to implement the same policy. You know, the quality of personnel is ultimately what makes or breaks a particular, you know, approach to foreign policy. And your point is well taken in the sense that, you know, it's an open question whether we can imagine American diplomats being able to competently make distinctions between the kinds of crises they face and the kinds of responses that they merit. But this is, you know, what happened with North Korea is in fact classic broken windows. This is a classic disruption of good global order, a vicious cyber attack on a private company that leads to with political ramifications. And so far, very little by way of a response from the administration, except what I read today was that it was going to be a proportional response. The right response to this, to what the North Koreans did, is to make it clear to them that the response that they will pay an unacceptable price for it. And what I would suggest doing, if I were the administration, is reprise what we did with Banco Delta Asia. I don't know how many people on this call remember this episode, but in 2005 we were trying to get the North Koreans to be good sports in the six-party talks. They kept refusing. And so finally we figured out that most North Korean financial transactions went through this one Macanese bank called Banco Delta Asia. And we froze its assets, and we essentially froze it out of the financial markets, which meant that cash flow to the Kim regime suddenly dried up. It hurt North Korea very, very badly, and they squealed very, very quickly. We should be, I think the right kind of response to this kind of cyber terror is that kind of asymmetric response that hurts the regime where it's most vulnerable, which is its desperate need for access to hard foreign currency to pay off the elite in that society. But a proportional response that, say, you know, names five North Korean hackers and says, you know, if you ever leave the country, we're going to sentence you to prison, which is something we did with the Chinese not so long ago, is going to be absurd.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got one more question on the line that we'll get to before the end of the hour. So we'll go to our last caller now.
Hi, this is Ariel Seufer. I'm also a Federalist Society member. Big fan of your column, too. Wanted to ask you a question about, you know, you mentioned the coddling enemies and treating friends poorly. You know, I think about this in an economist lens and say to myself, well, you know, we're creating bad incentives. People won't want to be our friends if we keep doing that. And mm-hmm. you know, think about that also with respect to, you know, what you mentioned about honoring our promises as well, and, you know, with red lines and you know, how that creates a clear picture that we don't really mean what we say. I just wanted to get your reaction to those thoughts about, you know, the interaction between honor, incentives, and, you know, our foreign policy thinking.
It's a brilliant question, and I thank you for asking it. I mean, the essence is that credibility is the great coin of the realm in great power politics when you don't want to resort to force. And our failure, our consistent failure with this president to honor our word, has led to diminished credibility that hurts us really in two ways. It persuades our enemies that we can be had, that they can act against us in really brazen ways without incurring devastating responses or punitive responses from us, but it also sends a signal to our traditional allies that they may need to freelance their foreign policy going forward. You know, one of the great advantages of Pax Americana is it kind of gave us, you know, what they call a right of first refusal. You know, if the Israelis were mulling a strike on Iran or mulling a strike on Syria, just to take a recent example from 2007, they came to us first, and at least we'd have the chance to say, well, we don't think it's a good idea, or we'd rather do it ourselves, or one thing or the other. That no longer is the case. You saw it with the furious Saudi reaction in 2013 to our erased Syrian red line, their contemptuous refusal to take a seat on the Security Council, a near total breakdown of relations with the kingdom. I mean, I'm not a great fan of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, but they are an important ally of the United States, and we need to be seriously mindful of it. Look at the Egyptians. Barack Obama has accomplished the extraordinary feat 6 years or 5 or 6 years after the Cairo speech of being more unpopular among Egyptians than George W. Bush was in his day. That's almost amazing. And that's because we're hated by the military regime, by the el-Sisi regime. We're hated by the liberal Democrats who feel betrayed. We're even hated by the Muslim Brotherhood, which feels betrayed, because we just proved such we didn't take Machiavelli's advice about being a firm friend and a thorough foe. We didn't take clear sides in that struggle, and as a result, we're left with no friends. So we're entering into this world of ambitious rogues and nervous freelancers, and it's an inherently unpredictable world on both sides of that equation. That's a scary place to be, and this is what I describe as the coming global disorder. You know, this ninth chapter of my book is where I take out my inner Tom Clancy, and I provide a scenario for the world in the year 2019. And I think if you read nothing else in the book, read that chapter and the chapter that comes after it, which is the prescriptive part of the book. But let me just close, since the hour is nearly up, by saying this. I am not at all a pessimist about the United States, and this is not a pessimistic book. As I said earlier on, decline is something you have no control over, very little control over. But the U.S. isn't in decline. Retreat is a policy choice, and it was the choice of one president to make it. It's the choice of hopefully the next president to reverse it. You know, the U.S. still retains enormous advantages over all of our adversaries, and I don't think that the question really about the outcome of our struggles with the rest of the world is in doubt. The real question is the price we're going to have to pay to achieve a reasonable outcome. Are we going through a period like just the kind of the Carter years, the post-Vietnam War era of sort of national drift and confusion? And are we going to snap out of it fairly soon? Or is this going to be a 20-year period of isolation, of reluctance to engage with the world, of letting chaos build upon crisis until we get to a point where we're going to have to intervene in a much more dramatic and much more costly way? And I hope it's the former. I hope it's a period of momentary drift. I wrote this book to make sure that this period was short. And its original title was 49 Shades of Grey, so it's very entertaining, I can assure all of you. And it makes a terrific Christmas present or Hanukkah present or any other holiday you might be celebrating anytime soon. So I hope you read it, and I hope this was a worthwhile hour for all of you.
Fantastic. Well, again, the book is called America in Retreat, The New Isolationism and the Coming Global Disorder. It's available on Amazon. The link is also on our website to the book. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Brett Stevens for joining us today. We appreciate you taking the time to be here. Thank you to our audience for your questions. We welcome your feedback by email anytime to info@fedsoc.org. A reminder that if you missed any of this, you can catch this podcast or this Teleforum call posted as a podcast, as well as all of our other Teleforum conference calls on our website at www.fedsoc.org. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thanks a million.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.